This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's a week since Ron Artest, Steven Jackson, and Jermaine O'Neal charged into the stands during a basketball game in Detroit between the Pistons and the Indiana Pacers. Those three members of the Pacers were suspended by NBA Commissioner David Stern, Jackson and O'Neal for 30 and 25 games respectively, Artest for the remainder of the season. Five other players received shorter suspensions for a variety of lesser offenses. On Tuesday, the NBA Players Association appealed the suspensions and argued that the current system, by which only Commissioner Stern hears appeals, is inappropriate. The union is pushing for the inclusion of an arbitrator in the process. For clarification of this and other issues related to the melee in Detroit last Friday night, Mark Monteith, who writes about the Pacers and the NBA for the Indianapolis Star, joins me now. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
The collective bargaining agreement between the players and the league compels Commissioner Stern to hear the appeals of the Pacers players, quote, as soon as it is reasonably practical, and then he's supposed to rule on the appeal within 20 days. But the union wants, quote, an expedited hearing with an arbitrator. Is the commissioner likely to agree with that change in procedure?
I think he will. I think he will allow arbitration just because it gives more of a sense of fairness to the thing. I mean, Commissioner Stern has an unbelievable amount of power in this. He not only made the decision entirely on his own, and from what I understand, without talking to any of the players involved about it, And now he also is the person who hears the appeal all by himself. And that's an incredible amount of power for one person to have over so many lives. You know, we have a nation here of due process, a judicial system, and there is none of that in this case. So I think it'd be smart for the commissioner to bring in an arbitrator or allow one, which he has done in the past when Latrell Sprewell was suspended back almost 10 years ago now. He had his sentence reduced somewhat by arbitration. However, the bylaws are so clear on the collective bargaining agreement between the owners and the players in the NBA, it's unlikely the arbitrator will do much about it because the commissioner does have, according to the bylaws, complete power over this.
On Tuesday, Pacers CEO Donnie Walsh said, quote, we have no clear idea on what we're going to do. Have Walsh and the Pacers developed a clearer idea now?
Well, they've talked a lot about it, and they're very upset about it. But they wanted to let this appeal process play its course. It doesn't do them any good right now to come out and be critical of the commissioner. They certainly have worked with the Players Association on this. There were attorneys representing the Players Association here in Indianapolis on Sunday, just 2 days after the incident, formulating a plan on it. So I think if the appeal is denied, I think at that point they will consider some other course of activity. I don't know if they would take this to court or not, because from a practical standpoint, it would take so long to play out that the season would be over anyway.
Because he has been suspended previously, Ron Artest has been the focus of a lot of the discussion about Friday night's brawl. On the one hand, Artest has expressed regret for his actions. He says, I wish it had never happened. On the other hand, he has busily promoted his CD. He started doing this a day after David Stern announced the season-long suspension. How are the Pacers fans feeling about Ron Artest these days?
Well, there was some feeling here that he made a public relations gaffe on Tuesday when he promoted the release of the CD. Now, it's important to point out that that was scheduled for release that day all along. You know, months ago, November 23rd was the day that this CD was going to come out. And I think he was kind of taking the advice of people related to the record company, because he had an opportunity to go on the Today Show, and he kind of took advantage of being in the news to pump a CD. From a PR standpoint, not a good thing, you know, related to the suspension. A lot of people saw that as, well, he doesn't care about this. He's not taking it seriously. He's not properly contrite. You know, he was genuinely sorry and apologetic for it, and said so, you know, as early as Sunday. One thing about Ron Artest that people who know him like about him is that he's authentic, and he's not going to do spin. He's not going to, you know, put on this whole show of contrition just to try to win over public opinion. He's going to state his opinion and go about his business. And it might surprise a lot of people to know that Ron Artest actually day-to-day is a very pleasant, happy person. I hear all kinds of commentators weigh in on his mental health, and people claim, oh, he's depressed, or he's bipolar, or he's this or that. You know, day-to-day, if you're with Ron Artest, he's got a very pleasant, gentle demeanor. He's a very dedicated athlete. He's dedicated to his recording. He's got four children. He's got eight dogs. He's a great family man. So this guy has a lot going on in his life.
It sounds as if you know Ron Artest pretty well from being around him on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
It's been suggested that Ron Artest could use some professional help dealing with the way he expresses his anger. He says, no, I don't need any help. Do you go along with that assessment?
Well, you know, I just don't know enough about psychology or medicine to be able to answer that. I asked him just this last Tuesday about that because people are suggesting he needs help, and he said, no, people don't know me. I'm by myself on this, and I know what I need to do, and I know what I did wrong. I thought that was a telling statement in a way when he says, I'm by myself, because I think he has a difficult time trusting other people. And I don't think that's difficult to understand when you learn more about his upbringing and his life as a kid. So I think we're talking about a temper and some immaturity, not medical issues that require medication.
The suspensions punish the three players involved, obviously, and they punish the Pacers as a team, but they're also designed to discourage other players from responding to fans who might taunt them or even throw things at them. Do you think these suspensions will work as deterrents?
I do. Certainly the suspensions and the enormous amount of publicity this has generated, because it's been a real black eye for the entire NBA, and it's been bad for the players involved. It's been bad for the fans in Detroit. You know, there's really nothing good out of it unless it leads to some improved behavior and improved bylaws and the collective bargaining agreement, that kind of thing. So I think it'll help, at least temporarily, you know, for a year or two, something like that. But who's to say in a few years that if a fan throws something or spits on a player or something like that, that the player won't respond? You know, you can never predict how somebody might react in the heat of the moment.
Mark Monteith covers the Pacers and the NBA for the Indianapolis Star. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Okay, thank you.
It may have been in part the heat of the moment following the moment that led Commissioner David Stern to suspend Ron Artest, Jermaine O'Neal, and Steven Jackson on Sunday. Asked after he'd announced the suspensions whether there had been any discussion of the appropriate punishment for the players who charged into the stands in Detroit, Stern expressed no hesitation in his characterization of the decision.
It was unanimous. 1-0. I don't mean to make light of it. It's my decision.
Beyond punishing the particular players throwing punches in the melee in Detroit, Commissioner Stern intended to send a message to everybody else in the NBA, and he hopes to those who buy tickets to the games as well.
We have to do everything possible to redefine the covenant between players and fans, and between fans and fans, and make sure that we can play our games in a very welcoming and peaceful setting. And that's what we're setting out to do.
Nobody who's attended an NBA game since the advent of tip-off to buzzer rock music, various electronic inducements to cheer more loudly, and rocking and bouncing cheerleaders and dancers can possibly mistake the setting for peaceful. But Commissioner Stern's purpose is clear. When he speaks of redefining the covenant, he's hoping to establish that such a covenant has existed. Eric Neal, who writes about the NBA for ESPN.com, isn't sure that's the case.
I think this is more a question of defining a covenant than redefining a covenant. I think what you have at a sporting event and at a basketball game is a tenuous but generally agreed upon idea that we're all here to have a good time. But I don't think there's any special covenant in the NBA. I don't think it's much different than anywhere we gather in groups where we all have this unspoken agreement to stay out of each other's way and to not ruin each other's experiences. But it's a fragile thing. I don't think Commissioner Stern can just sort of tap into, well, remember that covenant we have that's special to the NBA? Let's reactivate that now.
One assumes at least one part of Commissioner Stern's message to the players will be obvious. Attack a fan and you'll lose a lot of money and a slice of your career. Eric Neal hopes the commissioner will also recognize the need to reassure the players regarding their own safety.
The floor is easily accessible, as we saw the other night when Ron Artest hits the guy who came onto the floor wearing the sort of retro Pistons jersey. In that scene, for that guy to make his way to the floor, it's pretty remarkable, and it does highlight the question of, you know, what players are vulnerable to.
It's a valid point, though in this particular case, the vulnerable party turned out to be the relatively small fan at the end of the large fists of Ron Artest and Jermaine O'Neal. In the immediate aftermath of Friday night's fights and the suspensions that followed, The Indiana Pacers had to play several games not only without some of their starters, but without a full team, since restocking a roster takes time. Larry Bird, president of basketball operations for the Pacers, tried to put the best possible face on his team's shorthanded status.
We had a lot of guys that sit on the bench for a lot of years here and never had an opportunity to play. They're getting their opportunity now, and they know they're going to help's on the way. So they get an opportunity to improve their game now, and I think they'll take full advantage of that.
In the short run, that argument could be made. Since Friday's brawl, the Pacers have won three times, including last night's game against Charlotte. Maybe that explains why Indiana coach Rick Carlisle sounded optimistic despite last weekend's embarrassments.
You know, we're upbeat. Your greatest adversities can also be your greatest opportunities if you can view it that way. And right now, I really have great faith in the rest of the guys we have available. You know, this is a deep roster. It's no accident that this team's been able to win games in the absence of a lot of our top players over the last year and a quarter. So, I'm excited.
The same can't be said of Ron Artest, Steven Jackson, and Jermaine O'Neal. Though they will be allowed to practice with the team for a considerable while, they'll be learning what it's like to be fans. Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Nanotechnology, a process by which molecules are rearranged to create shapes that are stronger and lighter, may have implications for several sports. Nanodynamics, a New York firm, has manipulated the molecules in a golf ball so that it will spin less and travel in a straighter line. Another company, NanoSys, has a substance more slippery than Teflon that will allegedly allow swimmers covered in it to glide over the water. Most unhappily, at least according to former tennis champion John McEnroe, a French company is promoting a nano racket that will increase the speed of the ball by 30 miles an hour, which would mean a 180-mile-an-hour serve. Mr. McEnroe lamented, "No eye can see a ball that fast." I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, charities fight to survive the NHL lockout. But first, ESPN.com columnist Pat Forte joins me now on the line to preview the men's college basketball season. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Glad to be here, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. The Sports Illustrated cover jinx took only a week to work its dark magic. The magazine picked North Carolina to win it all, and the Tar Heels responded by losing to unheralded Santa Clara in the school's opener. Is that a bad omen for the Tar Heels or just a bump in the road?
Probably just a bump in the road, Bill, and I think we'll see plenty of bumps all over the place. You know, that Raymond Felton, their point guard, was out for that game, and they steamrolled through the Maui Invitational after he came back. They're going to be pretty good, but you know, I think there's going to be a lot of bumps in the road for a lot of people this year. Amazing number of supposed have-nots beating haves already in college basketball. Western Kentucky goes to Georgia and wins. Creighton crushes Missouri. St. Francis beats St. John's. I mean, everywhere you look these days, it seems like teams you have only faint recollection of are rising up and beating the quote-unquote established teams, and just goes to show that, you know, the college game is as unpredictable and as even probably as it's ever been right now.
North Carolina's intrastate neighbor, Wake Forest, is the number one team in the nation now, and a certain website starting with the letter E and ending with the letters SPN and then followed by a .com picked the Demon Deacons to win the title in April. Are you going to go and toe the company line here?
I don't know what website you're referring to. And actually, yes, and that was pretty much an Andy Katz production on that pick, but I agreed with it at the time. It's a fresh pick. It's somebody that's a little bit outside of the same old, and I think they're good enough to back it up. And Chris Paul, their point guard, to me, is maybe the most exciting player in college basketball this year.
kind of maybe taking over that mantle from Jameer Nelson after last year from St. Joseph's. And they got a lot of parts in a lot of places, a lot of good players, a great, great backcourt, and I think the front court players are good enough. And, you know, they're playing in just an unbelievably good ACC this year, so that's going to be a bloodbath. Teams are going to lose a lot of games probably there, but I wouldn't be surprised if at least half the Final Four isn't ACC teams by the end, and I like Wake Forest at the top of that list.
You mentioned Jameer Nelson and St. Joseph's, the small Philadelphia school that came within one shot of making it to the Final Four last season. St. Joseph's suffered a 40-point loss to Kansas this week, and St. Joseph's isn't even ranked in the top 25. What happened?
Well, you know, that's absolutely the feast or famine nature, I think, of schools at that level. I mean, Jameer Nelson is a once every, you know, 25, 30, 40-year sort of player at St. Joseph's, and then you add in Delonte West, his backcourt mate. You know, it was, you just don't get guys like that at that level very often. You know, that last year was their year, and now they're in the rebuilding process. And God bless Phil Martelli. He's got a great mouth on him, but we may not hear from him again for a while.
That's a great thing to say about a coach.
Love hearing him talk.
Well, who are we going to hear from? Who's this year's candidate for a, you know, plucky little underdog that, you know, goes a long way in the race?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure there's a great candidate for this year. I don't think there's a St. Joseph's, that's for sure. You know, there's a few of the usual suspect types, probably at the forefront of that being Creighton, which just, you know, that every year they're very good. But when they jumped up and beat Missouri by 25 or so this week, that certainly got my attention. That, and they're going to be one of those teams that's there to watch every year, and I would say this year as well.
Well, what other teams have gotten your attention for the opposite reason, i.e., how did this team get ranked so high? I don't think it's going anywhere at all.
Yeah, you know, so far, obviously North Carolina loss was a shocker, but I think, as I said, there was a reason for that. Louisville losing to Iowa. Iowa's pretty good, but the way they lost, it was Louisville lost by 5 points, but it was not a pretty loss, and really, I think, exposed that team with some of the same weaknesses that they had at the end of last year. And they, you know, they're going to have to do some proving to show that they really are, you know, one of the top 15 teams in the country after that. And they still have some interior issues and have some depth issues. Rick Pitino, one of the two or three best coaches in the country, I think, but his roster's not real full this year, so they might be struggling to live up to some of the preseason hype.
Okay, Pat, could you just amend that last comment to say Rick Pitino, one of the top college coaches in the country?
I know there's some Boston perspective we're dealing with here, and that's fine. If we want to make this a college discussion, then by all means.
That's all right. All right, Pat, we've spent some time now talking about the men's college basketball scene. Just to stem the tide, the inevitable tide of letters and complaints and emails that will come if I don't do this week, give me a pick for the women's side.
Well, you know, I will say this, that even though the superpowers, the, you know, the United States and Soviet Union of women's basketball both have lost, Connecticut and Tennessee, I'm willing to go out on a very thick limb and say that one of those two is going to be back there again at the end of this year. You know, that's my only problem with the women's game, really, other than the fact that they don't jump.
Oh, the letters are going to come now, man.
Forward them to me. That's fine. That's fine. It's a beautiful game on a lot of levels. It's the lack of parity, though, and the lack of balance, I guess, competitive balance. And, you know, you see the same teams dominating over and over and over, and I just don't see there being a real substantive movement to change that. And this year, I think it's still going to be the same old come April.
Pat Forte, whose mailbox will be stuffed with letters this week, covers college basketball and other matters for ESPN.com. He joined me on the line from Louisville. Thank you, Pat.
My pleasure, Bill.
As Pat Forte mentioned, Wake Forest is now the top men's college basketball team in the nation. The Demon Deacons haven't been to the Final Four since 1962, but that probably doesn't daunt head coach Skip Prosser, who's done some climbing of his own. Dave DeWitt of member station WUNC in Charlotte has our story.
The Wake Forest University campus in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is postcard perfect on this late fall afternoon. Fallen leaves stick to tree-lined paths as the sun sets over the towering brick chapel. It is a bucolic, hushed setting until you walk just a few yards away from the middle of campus and into the Miller Center, where the men's basketball team is holding a preseason practice. In this small practice gym with cinder block walls, head coach Skip Prosser holds court. The action is intense during the intra-squad scrimmage until sophomore Kyle Visser misses a defensive assignment.
Ow, you're a freaking team's list, Stuke. I just told you that last week.
Skip Prosser is not your average coach. Though he is intense and fiery and sometimes slips into motivational rhetoric, he also begins each Wake Forest men's basketball practice with a quiet team meeting devoted to non-basketball topics. He's a voracious reader who peppers his press conferences with words that often send sports writers scurrying for dictionaries. Prosser's players also benefit from his extensive vocabulary, including shooting guard Justin Gray.
He does the same thing to us, using words. When he uses it, you'd be like, hold on, let me jot that down, make sure I know what that means, because sometimes he says stuff in practice. I have no idea what he's talking about, but you better shake your head like you know, or he's going to yell at you. But, I mean, he's just one of the better coaches in the league, and not only in the ACC, but in the nation.
Prosser's players describe him with words like honest, tough, and funny. It's a style that has served him well for over 30 years, beginning with his first coaching job at Lindsley Institute in Wheeling, West Virginia. He began his career wanting to be something else.
I wanted to teach high school history. Going to the Merchant Marine Academy, I didn't take any education classes at the Merchant Marine Academy. I taught you how to drive ships, you know, across the ocean. I loved teaching. I was really looking forward to teaching the history, and I thought I'd do it forever, but I was at a private school that was in dire need of coaches. Basically, they said, we'll give you the teaching job, but you have to coach ninth grade basketball and help out with ninth grade football, and that was my introduction to coaching.
Prosser coached in high school for 13 years. Slowly moving up the ladder until he led Wheeling Central Catholic to a state AA championship in 1982. Skip Prosser made the jump to college coaching when he was hired in 1985 as an assistant coach at Xavier University in Cincinnati, getting the job only after three others turned it down. He would eventually become the head coach at Xavier, and then, in 2001, Wake Forest athletic director Ron Wellman hired him.
He really understood Wake Forest University and the type of institution that we are. He supported what the university stands for and was going to recruit within those parameters. He was going to recruit outstanding players, but great people as well, people who were truly student athletes.
Wake Forest is often overshadowed in the Atlantic Coast Conference by its powerhouse neighbors, Duke and North Carolina. But what some see as Wake Forest's weaknesses, its small size and out-of-the-way location, others consider to be strengths. Again, Ron Wellman.
10% of our students at Wake Forest are student-athletes. So our athletes are essentially in every class on campus. There are very few professors who do not have the opportunity of teaching student-athletes at Wake Forest. And that in itself is very unusual on a college campus, and it's just a reflection of the size of our university.
With the high preseason ranking come even higher expectations. The school has not reached the NCAA Final Four since 1962, and Prosser has never led a team past the Sweet 16. But there is a regular season to worry about first, which, says Prosser, has its good points and its bad points.
I don't read as much during the season because you're watching tape and worrying about, you know, practice and things like that, but I love to read. I don't have a lot of hobbies. I guess that's my only one. I read a lot of history. I read a lot of, you know, specifically Irish history.
If Wake Forest does make it to the Final Four this year, Skip Prosser will have made some history of his own. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Don't shoot layups in transition off of 1 foot unless you're wide open ahead of the pack. 2 foot power.
On the lockout front, the National Hockey League's owners are scheduled to meet December 2nd. This week featured rumors that the Players Association has been developing a new proposal, one that perhaps won't be absolutely opposed to the salary cap the owners contend they must have. The union has denied that that's the case. On Monday night, at Morton's Steakhouse in Boston, the ice was in the shaker rather than under the flying skates of the assembled former Bruins. But hockey fans at the martini tasting sponsored by the team's charity arm, the Bruins Foundation, were not gathered to drown their sorrows about the ongoing National Hockey League lockout. They had come together to talk with Bruins head coach Mike Sullivan, general manager Mike O'Connell, and former stars like Cam Neely. Coach Sullivan was not surprised by the packed house.
I think the hockey community has always had a conscience for those people in our community that are less fortunate than we are. And, you know, from my experience, both as a player and now as a coach, I think hockey people tend to reach out to those type of people. So it's refreshing to see that the interest of these people isn't lost, even though the game's going through a tough time right now.
A tough time is a euphemism for there is no NHL hockey. Through the first 7 weeks of the non-season, the Bruins are among several teams trying to replace fundraising events featuring current players with alternative options, one of which is a silent auction presided over by a young woman named Holly at the martini tasting.
Andrew Raycraft autographed hat and photo. Joe Thornton autographed puck and photo. Ray Bork autographed puck and photo.
It'll take a lot of autographed pucks and photos to match the $600,000 the Bruins Foundation raised last season, and the Boston team is still better off than most teams in terms of charitable work. Lots of Bruins alumni live in the Boston area, and most of them are generous with their time and their signatures. Teams more dependent on current players are having a tougher time meeting their charitable goals in this year of the lockout. Consider, for example, the 7-year-old Carolina Hurricanes, a team that hasn't been around long enough to have many alums. Emma Bennett, the community relations manager for the Hurricanes, says that in a normal season, lots of charities in the Charlotte area anticipate contributions from the Hurricanes.
Our foundation every year hosts golf tournaments, skating events, wine tastings, charity auctions, that type of thing, typically like most NHL teams. And that revenue ranges anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000 a year to great groups like Boys and Girls Clubs, Children's Hospitals, American Cancer Society. Since we're not able to have those, we are unfortunately cutting our funding by about 75% to all those entities.
For the past several seasons, Jerome Iginla of the Calgary Flames has donated $1,000 for each goal he has scored to an Alberta organization called Kidsport Calgary. Iginla's goal total this season is, of course, zero, which has dismayed Deborah Cluck of Kidsport.
Yeah, it's definitely affecting our bottom line here. Depending on the type of year Jerome may have had, where we will experience a loss between $30,000 and $50,000. Last year, Jerome gave us $54,000, which helped 270 kids in Calgary get into sport.
Some of the teams accustomed to charitable work have modified their events. For 21 years, the New Jersey Devils have run a food drive at a game. This year, with no games, they held the drive in the arena, peopled by Devils alums who provided autographs. The drive usually nets about 6,000 pounds of food. This year, Laura Sodano of the Community Food Bank of New Jersey didn't know what to expect.
There was a steady stream of fans between 6 and 9 p.m., and really, we were very encouraged. Every fan came along with a bag or two of food, and it really was a pleasant evening, and we were pleasantly surprised that we ended up with 1,080 pounds.
So that was roughly a sixth of what you would have gotten on a normal game night.
And yet that did prove to us, if that was a normal game, those Devils fans would have come through, because imagine, that was only a three-hour time where people weren't seeing a game. They were just driving up, you know, at rush hour. So even though we were short, We were pleased at what the Devils did for us.
The Devils and the other NHL teams may not be able to keep running charitable events for much longer, according to Boston Globe writer Kevin Paul DuPont, whose beat is the National Hockey League.
Well, I think the charitable organizations or divisions, if you will, of these teams are tethered to the full-time employees, the full-time, if you will, regular staff employees. And I think what you're going to see here in short order, particularly short order, if the league out and out cancels the 2004-2005 season, you'll start to see immediate layoffs. If they're laying off the regular workers and then also trying to feed the charity machine, they put themselves in a precarious position.
Though the lockout prevents them from having anything to do with their once and, they hope, future employers, the NHL's players are also thinking charitably. On Thursday evening at Yost Arena in Ann Arbor, Michigan, a group of locked-out NHLers led by Chris Chelios, Nick Lidstrom, and Chris Draper will play the U.S. National Under-18 team. Dave Roberts, who retired from the National Hockey League 3 years ago, organized the game.
I skate with these guys a couple days a week in Detroit, and they just love the game. I mean, Chris Chelios is 42 years old, and he's like a kid out there, you know. He loves to play. You're a hockey player for a reason, you know, and I'm hoping that they can, you know, the next couple of weeks here we'll have some good news. But meanwhile, we're going to make the most of the event.
Money raised at the game will go to the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor. Robert says he's ready to organize more charity games if the lockout continues, and since another group of NHL players, led by such worthies as Brett Hull, Joe Sakic, and Paul Coffey, will be competing in a charity event in Aspen, Colorado next weekend, it's kind of fun to imagine that even if the season crashes, there may be some sort of playoff. Huh. I wonder what kind of loot that would raise for charity.
That's it. Game over.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. And from dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the sports academy that agrees with you that Junior just could be the greatest athlete of all time. But first, a look at this week's news with Charlie Pierce, who joins me on the line from Ithaca. How's that Olympics expose going?
Well, I don't know about that, but it took me about 9.5 hours to get here on Wednesday, and I think I passed through not only the land of the Cyclops, but the land of the Lotus Eaters on the way.
Charlie, the reactions to last week's brawl in Detroit are only now beginning to subside. Pundits and even non-pundits have been making cosmic correlations, especially in regard to Ron Artest. What are some of your favorite conclusions drawn from this incident?
Well, the world is going to hell and all we need is a handbasket. That's the kind of global reference that we're all getting. I mean, this is the same kind of thing that happened after the famous Latrell Sprewell incident, which blessedly there was no television footage of, where we had not one, not two, not three, but four pieces in the New Republic over the next 2 weeks, describing the length, the breadth, the width, and apparently the land speed of the average handbasket. Don't ever underestimate the modern media culture's ability to turn something into something it can chew over for the better part of a month.
NBA Commissioner David Stern has said that the fight in Detroit makes it necessary to study the security apparatus in place in all 29 NBA venues.
Just saying?
Yeah, well, he wants the league to be able to guarantee that games can be played, quote, in a very welcoming and peaceful setting. Is such a guarantee possible?
Well, mass hypnosis comes immediately to mind. There's one way to do it. They could start selling certain Native American religious compounds at the concession stands. That's another one, rather than beer. I think this is David Stern attempting to address the other half of the problem, which he's declined to address punitively, which is that the Detroit Pistons should be heavily penalized for failing to keep control of their arena. He's a little bit wimpier on this end than he was with the players, I might point out.
Apparently, the brawl has not turned away league sponsors, hasn't discouraged them a bit. This week, Tony Ponturo, the president of sports marketing for Anheuser-Busch, said the beer company would continue to support the NBA. I guess that makes sense, considering how much of its product was flying around through the air Pistons broadcast.
Budweiser, a fine holiday drink and an excellent projectile. That was one of the primary concerns of the various Chicken Littles over the last 2 weeks, is that, oh, my goodness, corporate America will not want to be associated with this thing. Corporate America will want to be associated with anything until it starts costing them money, which this hasn't yet. Budweiser is not going to give up a captive audience of 26,000 people in 15 or 20 arenas every night. The fact that money trumps public morality should be no surprise to anyone.
Charlie, let's move on to that more tranquil pro sports league, the National Football League. Would you offer us your annual assessment of the two Turkey Day games, either of them a turkey?
Well, I confess I did not watch the Bears and the Cowboys, for I do not care about the Bears and the Cowboys. I did, however, spend a lot of time watching the Peyton Manning infomercial up there in Detroit. And while I am a Peyton Manning fan, and I certainly am happy that he's having such a great season, that was Exhibit A in the fact that the National Football Conference just closed up shop competitively for the rest of the year. There are some extraordinarily bad teams playing in that half of the league, and three of them played on Thanksgiving.
Miami Dolphins running back Ricky Williams may be back.
Legalize it.
Don't criminalize it.
Ah, it's just gorgeous, even over the phone. After a brief stint at a Northern California school for holistic medicine, he now claims to have enhanced healing powers, which should come in handy in the National Football League, don't you think?
I would think if we could have a little laying on of hands, we could save a lot on arthroscopes. There's no question about that.
There are now, according to NFL.com, 339 National Football League players who weigh over 300 pounds. I wonder if Ricky's holistic healing powers can create a slimmer, trimmer league.
Well, are there holistic weight loss programs? All I know is if a lot of people in the NFL take up Ricky's original training regimen that got him into most trouble in the first place, they'll be gaining all that weight on Cheetos and popcorn and not
a lot of sugar
weight
there. Yes, exactly. In addition to a European tour of locked-out NHL players, there will be a resurrection of the World Hockey Association, perhaps as early as the end of January. Will the current lockout, the World Stars Tour, and the new improved WHA put the NHL out of its misery?
I have no idea if people care enough about hockey to even parcel themselves out among the various acronyms. It will be interesting to see, though, if the revived WHA involves a return of the Hartford Whalers.
Absolutely. One of many questions that comes to mind. Which hulls will be involved
exactly
and to what
right.
extent?
Well, I think Gordy could probably still skate a wing.
Following a career path blazed by more than a few college legends who turned pro only to return to the hallowed halls of academia with tails between legs, Steve Spurrier signed a 7-year, multi-million-dollar deal this week to take over the University of South Carolina football program. He says he's learned humility. How long do you think that lasts?
He didn't learn any humility. You give him a shot to spell it, and he might make it to the first I. But, I mean, I do think he will do well at South Carolina. He will not do as well as he did at Florida simply because he does not have the in-state recruiting base that he has in Florida. But he will have the Gamecocks in a major bowl within 3 years.
Citing health reasons, Memphis Grizzlies head coach Hubie Brown announced his retirement on Thursday, Charlie. His arrival in Memphis in 2002 precipitated a dramatic turnaround for the relocated franchise. Can his replacement, Lionel Hollins, carry on the success?
I hope so, but it's really too bad because this was not only a very charming and very entertaining basketball team, but it also was kind of a rehabilitation of Hubie Brown's image, who was sort of this kind of soulless technocrat who, for many years, who thought basketball was best played by salt shakers on checkered tablecloth. Hmm. But he went down there. He loosened up a little bit. He played the happy grandpa, and he got those guys to play for him. It's really kind of too bad he won't see it through.
Residents of Singapore, which is a city known for its cleanliness and civic order, were shocked to see the new LeBron James ads for Nike, which apparently resemble graffiti. Is this, in your opinion, an example of callous disregard for local culture or just a carefully calculated exercise in controversy?
I think it's a carefully calculated exercise in controversy guaranteed to provoke ridiculous authoritarians like the people who run Singapore. But if I were LeBron, I'd stay out of there for a while because they really do know what to do with that cane.
Finally, Charlie, English soccer legend Sir Bobby Robson was recently crowned, quote, champion of the post-match verbal gaffe. In a new book entitled The GAFTA Awards, here's my favorite Robson gaffe, quote, there is no in-between, you're either good or bad, today we were in between. Do you have any favorites from others who might have been contenders for that prize?
We have Yogi Berra, who's sort of the past American master at this sort of thing, but I do remember once talking to Pearl Washington, the old talented point guard at Syracuse University back in the 80s, and he was talking about one of his rivals in the Big East Conference, and he referred to him as a CNP. And I said, what's a CNP? And he said, cannot play.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and he, CW, can write. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, we likewise are the kings when we're playing down the wings.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
You can hear the Geordie roar every time the Magpies score. We're the most united team in all the land. We're the most united team in all the land.
Always, it seems, the sports prodigies have been among us, and often they have received special treatment. Tomorrow's New York Times Magazine features a story by Michael Sokoloff about the latest development along that line. The IMG Sports Academy in Bradenton, Florida, now catering not only to tennis and golf hopefuls, but to youngsters who play team sports as well. Michael Sokoloff joins me now on the line. Michael, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
We should probably warn listeners at the outset, listeners who think this sports academy business sounds like a great idea for junior, that it's pricey. How much does the average parent of a junior major leaguer end up spending?
Well, the sort of base price is $42,000, but it is very easy with the extras that are offered to take it up to $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, or even more than $70,000.
Because some of these folks go and live on the campus in Florida. They don't just send junior away, as you might, to college for $40,000. They buy a condo.
Absolutely, because some of these kids are quite young, and their parents don't want to be sending them to boarding school and having them in a dorm there. So sometimes the whole family or part of the family picks up and moves and buys a very pricey condo on the campus of IMG Academies. You can get pretty much everything there.
At least some of the kids at the IMG Academy apparently managed to maximize not only their athletic skills, but their media savvy as well. Tell us about how Tommy Weingartner credited improvement in his social skills to the IMG training program.
Well, one of the extras you can get there is a program called Game On, which is media training for the younger athletic set. But Tommy found that it helped him with talking to girls. And he said to me at one point, I've talked to six girls so far. And one of his friends said, six? Did you keep track of them? Did you keep a list of them?
A list.
And then he asked him, well, when you talk to them, did they talk back to you?
It only counts if they answer, right?
That's right.
Were you able to keep a straight face when he started talking about the great benefit of this training?
Well, of course, because I'm a journalist, and one of the things we're trained at is keeping a straight face. And in a way, my heart went out to these people because just because you have lots of money doesn't mean you have lots of sophistication. And I didn't find any evidence that this was going to help kids realize their dreams, that especially for team sport athletes, that they could be trained like tennis or golf prodigies. So you have these kids who are really trying quite hard to advance in baseball or soccer or basketball, and their parents are paying lots of money, and they get some benefits out of it, but I just didn't know and don't believe that in the end they're going to get where they want to go.
Well, there is a school associated with the IMG Academy. It's called Pendleton, and one youngster with whom you spoke, I guess the same Tommy Weingartner who bragged about speaking to six girls, told you that the great thing about Pendleton was that the school, quote, respected his sport. What kind of message regarding education does that constitute for a 14-year-old?
You know, I mean, first of all, this is out of the mouth of a 14-year-old, so you can take it partly with a grain of salt. But clearly this place, the whole enterprise, is meant to put the sport first. And there's some lip service paid to what a great school Pendleton is and how much character building goes on at IMG Academies. And I think that, you know, some of that is true. But clearly the overall message is that these kids are sort of professional athletes at a young age, and they're being pointed toward this, whether they have the talent for it or not.
Well, that is a critical distinction, isn't it? Because the model that people are going to be familiar with is the old tennis academy, the Nick Bollettieri model, where, of course, you had to earn a spot. And if you weren't a very promising player, you weren't going to get to work with Nick. But you found that some of the team sport players devoting half of each day to their sport aren't all that good. What did their parents and what do they hope to accomplish?
Well, first of all, this program grew out of the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy. And even at the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy, you no longer have to be a great player. You just have to have parents who can write a big check.
I didn't realize that.
Absolutely. You know, there are 200 and some tennis players down at Nick's Academy now, and believe me, they're not all Jennifer Capriati's or Maria Sharapova's. They're rich kids. And this is now something else that's available to rich kids, just like SAT training or many of the other things that parents give their kids. But what I was surprised at, really shocked at, even knowing this, when I actually got down there, I was shocked at the mediocre level of athleticism and skills that I found of the kids across all the sports. You know, they weren't really that great. you know, this was not the cream of America's athletic children. And most of them, if they thought they were going to have a big future in sports, were really misguided.
One of the more telling points in the article comes when a soccer coach with whom you've been speaking says that he urges parents not to direct their children to concentrate exclusively on one sport too early in their lives, i.e. when they're 10 years old, and then he admits that the parents pay no attention to his advice. Why not? He's the expert.
Well, because in kids' sports, we see a mirror of society all the time, and this is part of the more is more philosophy. If 6 months of soccer is great, then 12 months of soccer is better. And people cannot be talked out of that. And if you say to a parent, you know, if your kid plays 4 months of soccer, 4 months of basketball, and 4 months of volleyball, in the end, they're probably going to be just as good a soccer player. Whenever it comes time to specialize, and there's a time for that, they're going to get where they want to go or as far as their genetics will take them. But that's not the model right now. The model is that if something is good, then more of it is better. And we really see that with kids' sports, and IMG Academies is just an outsized example of what we see in communities all across America.
Michael, you have spoken to the fact that some of these kids are really dreaming when they're talking about a career as a professional athlete. Is there any advantage at all for the good athlete to kind of specialize in the way that this academy makes possible?
I think there may be some advantage in tennis and golf, and I only say that because we've seen that work. We've seen that with Jennifer Capriati, with Tiger Woods, with others who are raised in this hothouse atmosphere. We've seen it work. IMG has moved over to team sports. I have seen no evidence that that will work or even is likely to work.
Forgive me for asking the question this way. Maybe it's not entirely appropriate, but the way you're discussing this, is this whole thing a con?
No, I don't think it can be described as a con because people have money and they can spend it where they want to spend it. And theoretically, they've attained that money by being something other than foolish. So I don't think this is necessarily going to ruin a child. They're going to go down there. They're going to play the sport they love. And they're going to get a reasonably good education, I think. I guess that's about as clear as I can say it. I think it would be too strong to call it a con. I wouldn't call it a con. I think it might be a dream.
Michael Sokoloff is the author of Constructing a Teen Phenom. The article will appear in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of The Ticket Out, Daryl Strawberry, and The Boys of Crenshaw. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from writer Michael Sokoloff. I asked him if the IMG Academy would be a viable option for my daughter.
That would be between you and your accountant, I think.
All right, then. And I'm sure my accountant will agree that this is a dandy plan, as long as they can overcome my contribution to their genetics. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.